This is AM with Sabra Lane.
Fires continue to ravage large swathes of Australia's southeast. We talked to people in the southern New South Wales town of Tathra, one of the worst affected areas. Donald Trump wants the death penalty for drug traffickers to stop the country's opioid epidemic. And the first comprehensive snapshot of its kind shows Australians are losing their teeth because of too much sugar and alcohol.
When only half of children under six have seen a dentist, we've got a problem. When so many children under nine are admitted to hospital to have teeth removed or treated aggressively, we've got a problem.
Good morning and welcome to AM. Destructive bushfires continue to burn across parts of Australia's southeast. Hundreds of firefighters are battling blazes in Victoria's southwest, where 18 homes have been damaged or destroyed since Saturday. But the biggest devastation has been on the New South Wales far south coast. 69 homes are destroyed, another 39 are damaged, and dozens more caravans have been incinerated. Thomas Arridi reports.
The agonising wait continues for residents of this tight-knit community. And as the people of Tathra come to terms with what's happened, more videos are appearing on social media, showing the moment a massive bushfire swept through their town. All you could see from the beach was a dark orange haze with thick smoke billowing from the streets behind, streets that are now almost unrecognisable. And locals say it all happened so quickly.
I went down the boat ramp for a swim, actually, because it was 41 degrees and I was only down there half an hour and it all changed in that time. It just went nuts.
We pretty much just jumped straight in the car and just drove straight down. But we got here to roadblocks and everything. Absolutely no way in.
The wind was really bad, blowing trees all over the road and we were dodging and weaving. Got into Tathra and I sort of looked at the smoke, but it's hard to judge how close it is.
A number of Tathra residents found out last night that their home was still intact. And they're lending a helping hand to some of their neighbours who weren't so lucky. But it'll take some time before we know the true extent of the damage. Ewan Ferguson is the area's newly appointed bushfire recovery coordinator.
A couple of immediate challenges. We've got to make sure that the area is safe before the community can be returned in there. So we'll be setting up a recovery committee. We'll be pulling together all of those agencies and entities who are involved in fixing things so that we can get people back home as soon as possible.
With asbestos inspections underway, no one will be able to return home until at least tomorrow. Christy McBain is the mayor of the Bega Valley Shire.
Some of the homes that have been destroyed were old and built obviously prior to the 80s, so we do have some experts coming in to make sure that fire ground is safe. If they can't let residents back in because of the asbestos risk, what will happen today is that there will be some buses going in to allow residents to view the full extent of the damage.
And insurers are just starting to reach the worst affected areas. Campbell Fuller is from the Insurance Council of Australia.
They're reporting widespread destruction of properties, but the final numbers won't be known for several days. Some householders are still even to find out what's happened actually to their homes, and the insurers are very much waiting on householders to lodge claims so they can get the claims process moving.
The bushfires aren't confined to Tathra. In Victoria's southwest, 18 homes have been damaged or destroyed since Saturday. Dozens of sheds have also been burnt out and hundreds of livestock have been killed. Terang, Camperdown and Cobden are among the worst affected areas. And although firefighters have made progress, Gavin Freeman from the State Control Centre says the conditions are far from favourable.
You can never be sure until they're completely out, and the state of Victoria is still very, very dry and no rain forecast for the next 7 or 8 days at least.
Slightly more favourable in the southeast of New South Wales, though, Bega Valley Mayor Christy McBain.
Conditions are much cooler. I think it's only meant to be about 21 today. Most of the fire is under control in the township itself. There is still some burning in some of the bush around Tathra, but we've had firefighters watching that for a long time now. So, yeah, the fire has been downgraded.
The Mayor of Bega Valley Shire, Christy McBain, ending that report by Thomas already. ABC reporter Gordon Taylor is in Tathra, where he spoke to residents who've had to leave their homes because of the fire threat.
The fire began innocuously about midday Sunday, just south of Bega, but fanned by ferocious winds and high temperatures, it jumped the Bega River and raced towards Tathra. Most residents decided to leave and were evacuated to the Bega showground, where they've now spent two nights. Beryl Marshall went to Bega, but was clearly frustrated over not knowing what had happened to her home.
Of course it is. How would you feel? Is my house there? Have I got somewhere to go? What will happen to me? Yeah, it's very unsettling.
Some, though, decided to stay and defend their properties, like Shane Gilbert and his dog, Luna.
To prepare the property, I had four hoses, two long hoses up on the roof, which were filling the gutters with water, and two shorter hoses on the ground, which were putting out the garden fires. What I could see from around here, there's fires that were... or houses that were being lost were from two sources. One, ground fires impacting on the house and then setting the house alight, and then the other one's the embers getting in under the gutters and setting the roof spaces alight. So that tactic, with my experience, worked well and saved our property.
Did you ever have a moment of doubt?
Of course. When the fire front came over at about 100 k's an hour, wind had significant doubt, but I just held to the line and just kept doing what we're doing and managed to contain the fires and kept the flames away from the house, and it's here.
Others, like Taz Fitzer, had narrow escapes, fleeing first to the beach before even that became too dangerous.
It was a bit chaotic. No one really knew what to do. All the internet was down in Tathra, so we couldn't follow any updates online from the RFS or anything like that. So we were all a bit confused and pretty nervous. Then when the police came and told us to evacuate, we had a lot of cars trying to get out of a pretty small car park, and so that was a bit chaotic as well, and just really stressful.
Tathra resident Taz Fitzer ending Gordon Taylor's report. Both the Tathra and southwestern Victoria fires have been declared natural disasters, allowing for a range of financial payments and counselling to help the victims. The Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull visited the region around Tathra yesterday to see the devastation. He was joined by the local federal MP, Mike Kelly, who's staying in neighbouring Bega. I spoke with him a short time ago. Mr Kelly, good morning. Thanks for joining the program. What were your first impressions?
Yeah, look, it's really been one of those situations where a mix of relief and grief, because we didn't lose any lives yesterday, and that's really a huge tribute to the community itself, which really rallied and looked after each other. They got around, you know, door to door, driving around, making sure people got the warnings and got out. And so we're really blessed that we didn't have any loss of life, but last night was really, you know, heavy duty grief, because that was where people were being advised specifically, you know, who had lost properties, and you know, so it all started hitting home last night, and we've got a big job to do in the days ahead to, you know, just look after, wrap ourselves around this community. It's really hurting now, and you know, the follow through is going to be important.
No lives were lost. Is that just good luck or good management?
Look, it was this community, you know, and this is a really special community. It's a very, very tight-knit community. And, you know, so often they've looked out for other people. They really have a tremendous social conscience, this group, and now it's our turn to turn around and look after them. But, you know, just seeing the wider Bega Valley community also reaching out was very special. You know, the Red Cross, Anglicare, Woolies crew, everyone chipped in, and I think that was a really big factor in helping those people feel, you know, that they weren't alone, and that's a really critical factor in those kinds of situations.
As you've said, it's a very small coastal town. It has a big influx of visitors at Easter and summer each year. The number of homes lost, how big an impact will that have on the community?
Oh, it's gutting, you know, because even if you didn't lose a home, you know, it was your neighbour or your close friend. And so there'd been, you know, 69 properties totally destroyed, but the other 39 that are damaged, it's still to be assessed of whether, you know, they're going to be salvageable. But, you know, we're really blessed with incredibly courageous helicopter pilots who were, you know, really braving some incredibly dangerous, difficult conditions during the height of that threat to the township with, you know, the gusting severe winds blowing embers forward of the fire line, taking out, you know, houses. They did a tremendous job. Everybody commented to me about that. So a really big shout out to the heroism of those helicopter pilots, because through all of this, 380 homes were saved and some really iconic historic landmarks for that community too were saved. The very historic Tathra Wharf, the beautiful old wooden wharf, could so easily have been lost. And, you know, my great-great-great-grandfather built that wharf, so it was a bit of a personal interest for me. But, you know, it's those kind of iconic things will make it easier for the community to re-establish itself. You know, we need to get behind them now. The mayor has set up a recovery fund, and I really encourage people to be as generous as they can in helping this community.
Some residents say that the local council wasn't focused on hazard reduction. What have you been told about that?
Oh, look, there'll be time to do all the lessons learned out of this afterwards. You know, I know hazard reduction's practiced right across this vast region of mine, and it's a heavily forested region. You know, we've been through some massive fire and disaster challenges like this before. The 2003 fires were devastating. So, you know, we draw as much as we can out of that. The conditions, though, for this fire were unique. You know, it was a really bizarre and erratic weather conditions, extreme heat, gusting winds, and the embers being transported long distances beyond the fire line, changing direction of the fire. So, you know, I'm not sure what else could have been done to deal with that sort of situation, frankly. But right now, the focus has got to be on the community. You know, we've got a community that's hurting right now, and they need our help, our support, our love, and making sure that we're following through on the concern that's being shown today.
That speed of the fire and the erratic nature, the town is also a notorious mobile phone black spot. Have residents told you that that was a problem on the weekend?
Of course, with mobile phone towers, they need power as well, and so power did get lost. And we were in contact with Telstra, and they were looking at getting a generator up there to see if it was just a power issue. But towers can also be damaged by fire as well. So if there is any concern about the tower in general, then Telstra are looking at bringing cells on wheels type facilities to try and get communications back up quickly. But, yeah, look, you know, communications is a really big deal. There was a real problem early on in that situation. We'll have a look at the lessons learned from that and how that might be remedied. But frankly, in the circumstances, it was, you know, obviously unique and very big challenge for that kind of warning system to operate properly.
And if I could just ask, what do you make of the Greens linking this particular fire and the Darwin cyclone to inaction on climate change?
Look, you know, if there's any community that's up for a discussion on climate change, it's the Tathra community, or the birthplace in our region of the Clean Energy for Eternity movement. But that's for later. This community now are just, you know, going through that terrible emotional rollercoaster ride. You know, the initial phases of the, you know, the sensory overload, shock and adrenaline, are now giving way to the emotional reality of what they've been told last night in the briefings at 6:30, and they're not going to be able to get back out to their homes until at least Wednesday afternoon now because of that asbestos issue that you heard reference to, just to make sure that the situation is safe. So, you know, the nights, you know, have been a nightmare, and, you know, we have to focus on them right now. This is about people first and foremost, and then we'll have this discussion about broader issues later on.
Mike Kelly, the local federal member for Eden Monaro, thank you for joining AM this morning.
No worries, Sarah, and just encourage people to be generous and give to the Mayor's Fund.
You're listening to AM, where it's 14 minutes past 8. The US President Donald Trump says he wants the death penalty introduced for drug dealers. Speaking at an event to stop opioid addiction, he warned that if the drug epidemic isn't controlled, there wouldn't be a United States. As Chief Foreign Correspondent Philip Williams reports from Washington.
Speaking in New Hampshire, Donald Trump had an audience and a simple message. His administration was coming after those who deal in drugs, and for the worst offenders, the ultimate punishment.
These are terrible people, and we have to get tough on those people. because we can have all the blue ribbon committees we want, but if we don't get tough on the drug dealers, we're wasting our time. Just remember that. We're wasting our time. And that toughness includes the death penalty.
The president made a bold promise to rid America of the scourge of drugs by the end of his second term.
And I want to win this battle. I don't want to leave at the end of 7 years and have this problem. Okay? I don't want to, right?
He added that building the wall along the Mexican border would stop a large percentage of heroin coming into the country.
The second part of our initiative is to reduce the supply of illicit drugs. 90% of the heroin in America comes from our southern border, where eventually the Democrats will agree with us and will build the wall to keep the damn drugs out.
Donald Trump cited unnamed foreign countries he said don't have problems because they have a zero tolerance for drugs. But he conceded not all Americans will favor the death penalty as a solution here.
Now, maybe our country's not ready for that. It's possible. It's possible that our country's not ready for that. And I can understand it, maybe. Although, personally, I can't understand that. Unless you have really, really powerful penalties led by the death penalty for the really bad pushers and abusers, we are going to get nowhere. And I'm telling you, we are going to get somewhere.
Already, groups dealing with addiction have rejected the president's solutions. Maria McFarlane Sanchez Moreno is from the Drugs Policy Alliance.
Neither the death penalty nor harsh sentences, which Trump has been proposing, would have any deterrent effect on drug trafficking. We know that these sentences do not reduce or stop drug trafficking, and in fact they have often the opposite effect.
But for many Americans, Donald Trump's simple rhetoric will sound sweet. The ultimate goal of ridding this nation of all drug abuse is about as tall an order as they come. This is Philip Williams in Washington reporting for AM.
Many of the perpetrators sentenced to death over the deadly sarin gas attacks on the Japanese subway appear to be one step closer to their execution dates. 12 people died and more than 4,000 were injured 23 years ago today when the Om Shinrikyo doomsday cult carried out its deadly chemical weapons attack. Now, 7 of the 13 inmates on death row have been transferred from the Tokyo Detention Centre to other facilities around the country, prompting speculation that the government is preparing to execute them. But some victims believe most of the convicted cult members should have their lives spared, fearing they could become martyrs. North Asia correspondent Jake Sturmer reports from Tokyo.
Hiroyuki Nagaoka has dedicated his life to helping Om Shinrikyo members escape the doomsday cult. He says he met Shoko Asahara, the cult's leader, 25 years ago. He immediately got a strong feeling the group would go on to do something terrible. He helped his son escape the cult, and that made him a target. Om members tried to assassinate him with VX nerve agent in January 1995. They failed, but 2 months later, the cult carried out its deadly attacks on the Tokyo subway. 5 men released the deadly nerve agent sarin in carriages of crowded commuter trains during Tokyo's morning rush hour. The cult had prepared at a remote sheep station it owned in Western Australia. Since then, almost 200 cult members have been charged and 13 have been sentenced to death. There's speculation the execution of 7 of those 13 is imminent. They've been transferred out of the Tokyo Detention Centre. But Hiroyuki Nagaoka wants them spared. So too does psychologist Kimiaki Nishida, because so little is understood about the cult and its motivations. He's the chair of the Japan Society for Cult Prevention, which supports clemency for all but the cult's leader. He was involved in the psychological evaluations for their trials.
If the 12 should be executed, we would lose a very valuable chance to learn about what has happened within the Om Shinrikyo group. A lot of these death row inmates have admitted that they have done wrong and they have left the Om Shinrikyo group. Now, The question that I have is what triggered that change? And how did their minds change? How did this translation occur? And if I were able to find that out, it would be a great help in countering these various terrorist groups.
Any decisions on clemency are up to the national government's cabinet. Executions in Japan are cloaked in secrecy, so it's impossible to predict exactly when any of the cult members will be hanged. This is Jake Sturmer in Tokyo for AM.
China's annual parliament, the National People's Congress, will finish today, and with it, Xi Jinping's remaking of the Chinese political system. Collective leadership has been left behind with a more centralised structure in place, giving all control to President Xi. So what will he do with that absolute power? Here's China correspondent Matthew Carney.
Human rights lawyer Yu Wenxun did the unthinkable in Xi Jinping's China. In an open letter last October, he criticised the president's totalitarian rule and called for immediate political reform and democracy. The next day, as he was walking his son to school, he was detained by security police and bundled into a van. His wife, Xu Yan, hasn't seen him since.
I'm very worried for my husband. No one can tell me what's happening. I can't see any hope for the future.
People in China are bracing themselves for another round of repression. And from today, Xi Jinping has a powerful new weapon. The National Supervisory Commission is a law unto itself and has the power to arrest and detain without charge. Foreign policy is likely to be much more assertive. Xi Jinping is now projecting China as a model for other nations to follow. Professor Stein Rengen from Oxford University says this is a dramatic shift.
Now that's a very new kind of language. An example of careless language of a leader who so far has been cautious.
Susan Shirk, a former China advisor to US President Bill Clinton and now professor at the University of California, says it's a direct challenge to America and the democratic world.
For decades, we've said that the U.S.-China relationship is different from the U.S.-Soviet relationship during the Cold War. We don't have this system competition global competition among political systems. But now Xi Jinping has kind of thrown down the gauntlet.
Professor Rengen says Xi Jinping will use his massive signature policy, the One Belt, One Road, a $1 trillion infrastructure project to enforce global dominance. 65 countries have already signed on.
This is the building of a huge structure of power. It is beneficial in that investments are spread around the world, but the cost of that benefit is that other countries get tied to China in the dependency of debt.
The biggest threat to Xi Jinping's rule could be a dramatic economic slowdown or financial crisis. Most Chinese accept Xi's new system because they believe it will continue to provide prosperity and stability. Take that away, and Xi's autocratic rule will be seriously questioned, if not toppled. This is Matthew Carney in Beijing for AM.
For the first time, the use of revolutionary new hepatitis C drugs around Australia has been mapped. And it's been revealed that in areas with high rates of hepatitis C, uptake of the treatment is generally low. Health authorities are trying to improve access to the curative drugs, with 1% of the population affected by the liver-destroying disease. Lexi Metherill reports.
The Northern Territory has the highest rate of hepatitis C in the country, but research by the Doherty Institute shows it has the second lowest rate of uptake of drugs that cure the disease. The Institute's Ben Cowie.
We really need to be focusing on lifting the treatment uptake in those areas where people living with hep C have lesser access to care.
It's a life-changing opportunity that's still to be taken up by many of the 1% of Australians who have hepatitis C.
This is not a rare condition. It's actually very common. And the consequences of chronic liver disease caused by chronic viral hepatitis C are that people end up with severe scarring of the liver or can get liver cancer. And liver cancer, as the fastest increasing cause of cancer death in this country, is responsible for a lot of premature deaths.
Fewer than 10% of people with hepatitis C in the NT took the drugs in 2016 when they were first subsidised. It's a similar story in Western Queensland and Brisbane South. Associate Professor Cowie says it's partly to do with a lack of specialists in some areas.
Any general practitioner in the country with appropriate support, if needed, can write a script for these drugs, for these life-saving drugs that in the space of 3 months can cure approximately 95% of individuals living with hepatitis C. So we need to really harness that opportunity.
Some places are doing well, like the New South Wales North Coast, where prevalence is high, but a quarter of sufferers are getting treatment. Associate Professor at the Menzies School of Health Research, Josh Davis, has run a liver clinic in Darwin and says the key is identifying people who need treatment.
And that revolves around health promotion campaigns, targeting people who have ever injected intravenous drugs, and it might have only been once or twice in the 1980s or 90s, and then less commonly those who have had blood transfusions before the 1990s and medical procedures overseas, for example.
The federal government's chief medical officer, Professor Brendan Murphy, remains confident Australia will hit the global target of eliminating hepatitis C by 2030.
We are going to depend on GP prescribing. GPs, these are new drugs. They weren't familiar with them and they need to get comfortable with them, and they are getting comfortable with them, and I'm confident that GP confidence with using them will increase, and we'll see even more increased uptake by GPs.
The research helps those trying to improve access to Hep C drugs. Helen Tyrrell is the Chief Executive Officer of Hepatitis Australia.
We can now accurately target GP education and community awareness to those areas shown to have lower treatment uptake but higher rates of hepatitis C.
Hepatitis Australia's Helen Tyrrell ending Lexi Metherill's report. Did you know about 67,000 hospital admissions happen each year because of complications with teeth? It's a pretty worrying statistic contained in a first ever comprehensive report card on the nation's dental health. The culprits of tooth decay, experts say, are too much sugar and alcohol, and they're particularly worried about the state of decay among children and the elderly. The specialist reporting team's Alison Branley has this report.
Hey Angus, how are you? Good, you're going to come and sit in the big chair?
At this dentist, 8-year-old Angus is getting a checkup and a lesson in the importance of brushing his teeth.
Sometimes my little brother, he just brushes the teeth with no toothpaste.
But some Australians are failing to master this basic lesson. A first ever comprehensive snapshot of the nation's dental health has found only half of adults brush their teeth twice a day. The Australian Health Policy Collaboration has published its oral health tracker to highlight the serious health implications of poor dental care. It's found 90% of adults have some form of decay, and there's more than 67,000 dental-related hospitalisations each year. Dr. Rosemary Calder runs the research centre and says the child dental health statistics are the most troubling.
Clearly we need to see how we can do better for Australia's children. When children, only half of children under six have seen a dentist, we've got a problem. When so many children under nine are admitted to hospital to have teeth removed or treated aggressively, we've got a problem.
She says among adults, smoking and drinking rates are also having an impact.
It can get as bad as oral cancers, and that leads to premature death. We know that, in particular, high alcohol consumption is associated with oral cancers, but also losing teeth through dental decay.
Dr. Hugo Sachs heads the Australian Dental Association. He says there needs to be more community education and better disclosure of the many sugars in foods.
Packaging of goods doesn't really declare the added sugars that occur within products that we buy, and some of those are considered to be healthy. And from a dental viewpoint, that's certainly not the case.
He says it's not a question of getting a dentist appointment with an oversupply of dentists nationally. Rather, he'd like to see more subsidised treatments for the elderly and more dental health research.
There are vulnerable Australians that can't gain access, and something has to be done.
Dr. Hugo Sachs ending that report by Alison Branley. Checking finance now, Wall Street's ended weaker amid expectations that the US Federal Reserve will raise interest rates later this week. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down 335 points or 1.4%. Oil is steady at $62 a barrel, and the Australian dollar is low at 77.1 US cents. That's AM for today. I'm Sabra Lane. It's 8:30.